Hello and welcome, Speaking to Legends podcast, and I'm your host, Nikita Fadeev. This show is a quest for ideas, insights, and stories from the lives of the most successful hedge fund managers, investors, and academics. You will learn about their spectacular careers, their life lessons, and their investment techniques. To dive deeper, visit our website at speakingtolegends.com, where we'll offer show notes to each episode. The legend of today is Ewan Kirk. Ewan is a known and recognized figure in quantitative finance. He started his career in finance at Goldman Sachs, spent 13 years there, and retired as a partner. Subsequently, he launched Cantab Capital Partners, a Cambridge-based hedge fund, which managed close to $5 billion in assets under management at its peak. In this episode, we discuss Ewan's path into finance, his time at Goldman, creation of Cantab, and principles on which it was built, as well as life lessons he learned along the way. Let's get right into it. Hello, Ewan. It's really great to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thanks very much, Nikita. It's great to be here on the podcast. I don't think I've ever done a podcast before, so this will be a brand new experience for me, as I'm looking forward to it.
Really exciting. So let's kick it off then. Let's begin by learning more about your upbringing. Where did you grow up and how did you get interested in maths and science?
I grew up in the west of Scotland. I went to one of the largest comprehensive schools in the UK, Green Falls High School. And it was a challenging environment, shall we say. And you know, there was only really, you know, I wasn't very good at playing football and I wasn't very good at fighting. So the only thing that I could actually do that might get me out of Cumbernauld, where I grew up, was to be good at maths and good at physics. And I was a kind of geeky kid. And so that was the thing that I concentrated on doing. It was a very tough school. So being able to do maths was a route out of that, if you like.
And did it immediately resonate with you? Did you straight away knew that this is something that you would want to build a career around?
I'd always liked maths and science. I'm of the generation where, remember, things like the space race, the Apollo missions, were on the TV all the time. I mean, I remember staying up and watching, you know, the first moon landing, Neil Armstrong. And that was just a big, big thing. And I got into... I read a lot of science fiction when I was a kid, and so that led me on to books that, for example, Isaac Asimov did on popularizing science. And I just loved all of that stuff, Martin Gardner's books, you know, the reading Scientific American. It was just a thing that I really liked, and it was something that I appeared to be quite good at, right? It was, and... you know, not to put too fine a point on it, it was something that I was quite good at without actually having to do a huge amount of work. And so I sort of liked that, you know, compared to languages, for example, which I am truly terrible at languages. I mean, you know, I'm teaching myself Spanish right now. And you know, Spanish just goes in one ear and comes straight out of the other ear. Yet I can still remember facts that were in some book that I read when I was 14 that was popularizing science, right? I mean, I guess that was the time when things like the Standard Model came out for particle physics. And I can still remember that stuff. But can I remember my O-level French? Not a single word of it. It's all gone.
Yeah. Isaac Asimov inspired like a whole generation to be like interested in maths, technology, science, and that's all together. And kind of maybe progressing a bit further in terms of like your age, what started your passion for applying scientific rigor to financial markets?
So I did a degree in physics and astronomy, and then did part three of the maths tripos at Cambridge, and then went to Southampton to complete a PhD in general relativity. And basically, up until I got sort of to my PhD, I thought I was on the academic research track. You know, because I was good, right? I was top of my school. I was good at university. And then, of course, you get to a point at which you realize you're just not good enough. You know, there's a statement that, if you like, everyone's career in mathematics is just about the point at which you fail. You know, for some people, they fail when they're 15 or 16 and they don't get a GCE in mathematics. For some people, it's A level. For some people, it's degree and so on. For me, it was PhD. It's not that I failed. I did my PhD. But I realized that although I was good, I wasn't good enough. And at the same time as I was doing my PhD, I'd been running a software company. I was teaching myself to program, you know, early C compilers and Pascal compilers and wire wrapping processors into breadboards. And I'd got into computing at that point. And I also ran a symbolic algebra server that we had running in the maths department. And I became the system administrator of that. So that taught me all about Linux and or BSD Unix, as it was called in those days. And so I started to get quite techie in that programming way. And I spent a bit of time working for a firm in Cambridge that was a sort of technology consultancy. And our job there was to come up with some cool idea. You know, we'd all have a brainstorm session on Monday mornings. We'd come up with some cool idea, and then we'd go and try and sell it to a company as a consultancy project. And we did lots of really interesting stuff there. But for various reasons that I probably can't go into on a podcast, the firm didn't manage to survive. And sort of out of the blue, I ended up at Goldman Sachs. And, you know, I remember, you know, I didn't have any desire to be in finance. You know, I didn't know anything about finance. You know, as I said to the Goldman partner who wanted to hire me, I said, you know, I don't even know what it means to balance a checkbook. I don't know any of this stuff. I really don't. And I was hired into the energy trading group. I think the energy trading group were as surprised at me turning up there as basically I was to be there, if you like. You know, I had no idea what I was supposed to be doing. And they didn't really have any idea what I was supposed to be doing either. You know, I was just the geek on the desk. And so for the first 6 weeks, I remember crawling around under traders' desks, fixing their telephones for them because there wasn't really anything else for me to do. But it was clear that there was just a lot of opportunity because that was the early 90s. And there was the explosion of derivatives pricing at that point. So, you know, we'd gone through the period of people starting to trade calls and puts and, you know, exciting stuff like Ito's Lemma and Black-Scholes. And then there were all of these strange exotic options like knockout options and contingent premium options. And these were all being done in the interest rate and FX space. There was lots of that stuff being done there. And so after I got a bit bored fixing people's phones, I kind of wandered over to, there was a couple of guys in the what used to be the J. Aaron business, as it was called, were working in the foreign exchange thing. And I'd say, hey, what are you guys doing? And they'd say, oh, we're doing contingent premium options on dollar mark. And I'd say, oh, how do they work? And then I'd go back to the oil desk and then I'd price them up and I'd say, look, we can do this on oil or jet fuel or fuel oil or whatever it will be. And it just kind of turned into a massive business or, you know, the ability to do all sorts of extraordinary recasting of risk, because that's really what options trading is. I mean, options, you know, is about changing the distribution, and you can change the distribution in a way that the client benefits in the right way, and you benefit too, because you, I don't know, you sell, you know, volatility is trading at 14% and you trade it at 14.5% and you've made a profit as long as you delta hedge everything properly and do all of that. So that was really my introduction to finance. That's where I got started on it.
So it sounds like you obviously had a very good background and strong experience in maths and computer science. And then in a sense, like in Goldman and back in the day when it was still like a bit smaller organization pre-IPO, it was, I wouldn't say that it was a startup, obviously back then it was still already a 100-year-old enterprise, but it was much more entrepreneurial, and by going from team to team, speaking to being part of this meritocratic organization allowed you to kind of learn this commercial aspect and to essentially find a way how to apply your ideas to like profit-making mechanism.
I joined the part of Goldman which they bought in the mid-80s, which was the J. Aron commodity and foreign exchange trading business. And J. Aron was always very scrappy. It was much scrappier than the rest of Goldman Sachs, if you like, the equities trading and certainly the investment bank. And it really was incredibly entrepreneurial. You know, there was this sort of feeling from the partners who ran it. And of course, then it really was a partnership. There was a very strong feeling from the partnership that you know, what have you done for me today? Right. You know, what's the thing? Have you made money today? Have you done something today? And, you know, it wasn't just the really good thing. And one of the things that I always remember is that it wasn't just a question of making money for money's sake. The phrase that's often used in sort of partners meetings and things is about being long-term greedy. So don't do something stupid. You know, there were lots and lots and lots of really appalling deals, which, you know, and some of them I have to say I was responsible for coming up with. I mean, one of the problems when you've got a massive toolkit of really interesting looking options and structures and, you know, debt structures and derivative structures is you can come up with things that look really very good, but actually they're just really terrible deals. And that was something that, you know, one of the great things about the Goldman partnership was here I was, you know, sitting on a trading desk, and the person sitting next to me on that desk was the partner in charge of the oil group. And the person sitting opposite me two rows down was the partner in charge of sales. And, you know, I'd turn around to this guy and say, hey, we could do this for airlines. And he'd say to me, and I'm not sure whether or not I can swear, but you can always bleep this out. He'd say, just imagine it was your money that you were fucking with here. Would you do this? Because it is my money that you're fucking with. And that was the partnership, right? And I'd look at this horrendous piece of, you know, derivatives nonsense. And I go, yeah, that's actually a terrible thing to do. We won't do that. And there were more deals that we didn't do than we did. But commodities was a great space at that point because it was underbanked and it was underquanted as well. I mean, by the time we got to 1998 in the commodities business, we had 15, maybe 20 quants, strategists, as they were called in Goldman, working in the commodities business. Our nearest competitor was Morgan Stanley, and they had two. And it was just an area where, you know, because not a lot of people are doing it, you can have really quite wide spreads, and wide spreads are good. Obviously, you make more money on that. But also, there was a lot of risk to manage. You know, we'd do some hedging transaction for a sovereign oil producer, and you'd say, done, and you'd have 50 million barrels of oil dumped on your book. You were suddenly long 50 million barrels of oil, right? That's not something that you just turn around and hedge out in the market. That requires incredibly skilled traders to be able to do that. And so it was, I mean, it was fun. It was very commercial. And part of the reason I think, I mean, one of the things that I learned in that period was that the salespeople were incredibly interested in having the quants go and talk to the clients. So very often in banks, what happens is salesperson goes to meet client, salesperson comes back with an idea which maybe isn't really possible, who then speaks to the trader, and then the trader then speaks to the quant to try and build a model. And it's all just lots and lots of opportunity to make a mistake. At Goldman, particularly in the commodities business, there was this concept of a sales strategist or a sales quant whose job it was, he or she would go and travel around the world with salespeople and go and talk to gold companies or oil companies or people who produce wheat or refineries and actually understand what the problem was. And if you're good enough at that, you can kind of get a good intuition about what might be possible. And it's a very strong relationship and it's very powerful. And that kind of taught me a little bit about how to be a salesperson. Because one of the things that's often lacking, and I know I've talked to you, Nikita, about this sometimes, is it's very hard for quantitative people to pitch, for want of a better word, to pitch themselves and to be in that commercial conversation. And that is something that Goldman really taught me and allowed me to be, you know, at the table. And if you're at the table with, you know, some of the best salespeople and best traders in the world, all you have to do is listen and watch. You just watch what they do. How did that, you know, this client has just asked a really difficult, tough, pointy question. Yet that salesperson over there, she's managed to turn that around and deflect that in a really clever way. How did she do that? Right? That's the learning experience that you get from being at that level. It was life-changing for me to do that.
So many interesting things you touched on. If I could pick one, so like this phrase of like long-term greedy, I think it is just, you know, kind of coming to the origins of it. And when the senior partners like Gus Levy or like Sidney Weinberg, these guys, they were, you know, just really building like a company around like this partnership. And obviously you got to the partnership status like in a pretty fast fashion. And as a process for, obviously Goldman has like this process for like, you know, getting partners named. And it's like every few years time. And then the senior partner or the CEO these days give you the call. So did you expect to receive the call? What did you feel when you got it?
It's an interesting thing because, of course, I was a partner post-IPO. So there was this, you know, the partner school of 98 where, you know, it was an exceptionally lucrative event, that going public. I often say that I own the most expensive PhD in the world because had I not done my PhD, right, which, let's face it, has no input really into, I mean, general relativity is about as far away from finance as it is possible to be. Had I not done that, then all things being equal, I would have been a partner at Goldman in 1996. And then I would have been a pre-IPO partner and things. So that was a very expensive thing for me to do a PhD in retrospect. But then again, I'm still glad I did it. There's a kind of unwritten rule at Goldman where you kind of do the job of partner for 2 years before you make it. So it never comes as a surprise because you're kind of doing the job already, right? And it should never come as a surprise to somebody when Lloyd, or when it's Lloyd in my case, phones you up and pats you on the shoulder and says, you know, we'd like you to join the partnership class. It's not a surprise because you know you've been doing that job. You act like a partner, you do the job. And I've been doing that for 2 years. I made MD in 1998 and then partner in 2000. And I knew that I'd been doing that level of a job. I mean, I might not have been made a partner. You never know. And the process is, I mean, it's not quite as secret as when they choose a new pope, but it sometimes feels a little bit like that. You know, there's an enormous, you know, as I knew, once, of course, you're a partner, you're then responsible 2 years later for cross-ruffing and the whole process for new partners in the following year and on again. And it is a very intensive process.
Yeah, fair enough. It's interesting how you look, you know, at these things in retrospect about like, you know, PhD, not PhD, but the crucial component there is that is this of like all else being equal, and that can change. It's like, you know, this butterfly effect.
Yeah. that can absolutely change. And all things being equal, you know, if I joined Goldman Sachs 4 years earlier or 5 years earlier, however long it took me to do my PhD, I might have ended up somewhere else in a different part of the firm where, you know, I was very lucky to end up in commodities because commodities was an area that was very fertile. If I'd ended up in interest rate swaps or the investment bank, God help me, then then things would have been different. You know, this is something that I'm intensely aware of, is almost everything is about luck. It's about being in the right place at the right time. And it just so happened that I was in the right place in the early 90s because, and I had a set of skills. You know, I was a pretty good programmer. I was a pretty good mathematician, and I was a pretty good salesperson. I wasn't a great salesperson, and I wasn't a great mathematician, and I wasn't a great programmer. And I was just lucky to be there. And then this whole commodities hedging world just grew like topsy for 6-8 years. And I was there on the ground floor, and I was lucky to be there. And yes, if things had turned out differently, then all things being equal is a very strong statement that I'm not sure we can really hold to.
After becoming a partner, you spent a few more years at Goldman, and then you decided to spin out, to set up your own shop, Cantab Capital Partners. And presumably it was quite a challenging decision in the first place to make the step and then to set up the enterprise. Maybe you can just discuss a few things around that, and maybe also discuss the Goldman deal that you managed to arrange.
After I sort of made it to partner, I started taking responsibility for more businesses other than just commodities. So it's a foreign exchange, and then interest rate swaps, and then credit, and then finally in the last couple of years, the equities business as well in London. I didn't leave Goldman to start Cantab. In fact, I didn't leave Goldman to do anything at all. You know, what I realized was I sort of got to the end of the road at Goldman. You know, I could have continued to be there, but it becomes much more managerial. And without in any way being pejorative about it, it does become more political. And I'm not really very good at that. So I'd sort of realized that I'd a little bit come to the end of the road at Goldman. I didn't really know where I wanted to go. And so I literally just retired and said, I'm done. I have no plans. So that was the beginning of 2005. And it was, of course, it's a difficult decision. I mean, it's a very difficult decision to make for lots of reasons. I mean, you're leaving behind literally hundreds of people that, you know, them incredibly well. You've been working with them for years. You know, it's really difficult to walk away from that. And so I made a complete change. I had a year where I bought some more guitars. I bought some more motorcycles and then sold them. I went to the gym every day, and I traveled around the world with my family for 3 or 4 months, all sorts of fantastic places. And it was great. And I really absolutely just didn't think about what I was going to do, right? Because it's a terrible mistake to make. Particularly serial entrepreneurs make that mistake all the time. You know, they come out of one thing and then they go straight into another thing without giving themselves time to decompress. And so literally January 2006, I sort of sat down with a blank sheet of paper and I made myself 4 rules. And these were my rules. Rule 1 was I would never commute again, because I'd lived in Cambridge and I'd commuted to London, man and boy, to Goldman. And that was grim and horrible and I didn't like it. Okay, so that was rule number 1. Rule number 2 was I would only do things that I liked. So I like programming. Right? I like maths. I like markets. I like the performance aspect of selling, you know, being in a room with people and trying to explain what you do and them deciding they don't like it or they do like it and trying to understand what they want. I like that process. So I just said, you know, if I'm going to do something on my own, then, or I'm going to start something, it has to be in Cambridge and it has to be things I like. The third rule is an interesting one, because it has to be something which is sufficiently difficult, if that makes sense, right? The phrase I use is on the edge of failure, right? You want to do something which is on the edge of failure, because if it's on the edge of failure, then it's hard. You're going to feel good about it if you succeed. Whereas if it's something that's really easy, if you succeed, it's kind of, well, I haven't really done anything. And the fourth rule was, I would never hire anybody I didn't like. Simple as that, right? Life's too short. You don't want to work with people that you don't like. So I kind of thought about that and I thought, right, well, you know, I think I could probably start a quantitative hedge fund, because what we did at Goldman, I guess, was we gave really brilliant technology infrastructure to really smart people and pointed them at really difficult problems, and they made quite a lot of money for Goldman Sachs. So I thought, well, why don't we get some really good software, some really good people, and some hard problems, and predicting markets is a really hard problem, and we might be able to make money for investors. So we started the firm. We did have a sort of licensing agreement with Goldman where we got to use some of their SecDB technology. But over the course of, you know, the first few years at Cantab, we rebuilt that in our own infrastructure, all written in Python. And it was a really fantastic thing to start, because we started off with great software and great technology and great data. But it was important for us eventually to write our own stuff. And in case anybody who's listening is thinking about this, Goldman doesn't do that anymore.
I think it was probably a rather unique setup even back in that day. But just coming back to this, like, four principles, I think it's really fascinating that here you are, obviously had like really successful career at Goldman, got to the partnership, and now you're sitting with a blank sheet of paper, and then you kind of ask yourself, what are the most important things for me? And kind of you then created this ecosystem to solve for happiness, right? To make yourself enjoying every day, right?
Yes, at least you set it up to optimize each day to have a fair amount of happiness in it. I mean, you know, let us not forget that running a $4 or $5 billion hedge fund and 60 people has its moments of stress, terror, fear, depression, anger, and all of the rest, just like any job does. But if you don't have all the other stuff, like you're not doing things that you like doing, or you're working with a bunch of assholes, that makes it much harder. Whereas if you're working with a bunch of really smart, really clever, really nice people, then it's just a lot easier to get through the difficult times.
No, I mean, makes sense. And then this is where the rule three about being on the edge of failure, that's, you know, it doesn't mean that it's easy, right? But speaking about some milestones along the way, so like you set it up the fund, you got the first capital, you build the infrastructure, hired some people. What was this road to the first big milestone, which is reaching the $1 billion in assets under management?
Oh, that's an interesting question. We got all our employees together, or at least the initial team. And a lot of that initial team is actually still working for Cantab, or GAM now, as it is. Maybe in September 2006, and we just built a trading system, you know, that could manage multiple models and multiple assets and do positions and create signals. And when the signals get written down or get emitted, then it, you know, you trade it, and you know, this is sort of basic stuff, but we built it as flexibly as we could with a huge amount of opportunity to extend it. And for, I guess, sort of 3 months before we launched on the 1st of March, I just went around and met investors some of our prime brokers at the time were very helpful in terms of setting up meetings. That was in the days when prime brokers had capital introduction services. And we got a list of maybe 50 people. And I had no idea how to sell a systematic hedge fund. I just didn't know what people wanted. So we took the list of 50 investors and we rank ordered them in order of how likely they were to invest. Like, you know, had they invested in systematic firms before? Were they sort of geeky people or were they not? And then I started at the bottom of that list with the people who were never, ever, ever going to invest in us. And, you know, I wrote the initial 20-page deck and I went out and I spoke to Swiss family offices and small foundations who literally hated the whole idea of model-based trading. Okay. And those meetings were really rough, but I learned a lot, right? You know, I remember the very first time that somebody said, "What's your investment philosophy?" And I thought, "I have no idea." I just completely stalled in the meeting because I thought, wait, I don't understand. What do you mean by investment philosophy? And of course, what they meant was, you know, are you top down or bottom up? Right? That was the only question they were asking, but I didn't know that. So we managed to raise, you know, some money from friends and family, some money from small institutions, and we started with $30 million, which is not much money. And for the first few months, I mean, it was really touch and go. You know, that didn't create a huge amount of management fee. We, you know, if you remember, in 2007, there was the quant quake, as it was called. And we, you know, we didn't have a great month, but we don't trade at that time, we didn't trade equities at all. So, I mean, it wasn't really, I mean, there was a bit of a risk off thing going on. But now, I then had to spend sort of 4 months going and talking to clients and prospects and things saying, no, we're not that type of trader. We're not the people doing small cap relative value at super high leverage. But the money gradually came in over 2007. And then 2008, we did really well in 2008. I mean, our 20% vol share class was up nearly 50%, which was fabulous. I mean, really very nice indeed. But of course, you fall into this trap, and this is often the case with CTAs and more broadly with uncorrelated investments. You do your best when the world is falling apart, but nobody wants to invest in you, not because they don't want to invest in you, but they haven't got any money because they're too busy firefighting in the rest of their portfolio. And we had a problem. We had some money inside Lehman's that we couldn't quite get out, so we had to side pocket it. So 2008 should have been great, but you know, when the world's falling apart around about you and you can't raise money as fast as you want, then it's pretty difficult. But 2009, we, you know, things didn't start very well there, but we had a reasonable 2009, and then basically, you know, things started going. We got to about $1 billion at the beginning of 2010, maybe around about the middle of 2010. We didn't celebrate that quite yet. I mean, I think we all went out to the pub and had a bit of a celebration, but we didn't really do very much on that because it still felt a little bit unsure. You know, it's unsure what we were doing. You know, were things going to be okay? I mean, the markets and models and all the rest of it were quite febrile at that point. And so it didn't really feel quite right to be doing, to do any celebration. But what we did do, which was an important thing to do at that point, was we actually hired some people to go and market. So we didn't really have a marketing team up until the beginning of 2010 and going forward. And then we hired some great marketers who basically, the way that they were trained up was they just spent hours and hours and hours and hours in meetings with clients with me doing the pitch, right? And we'd come out of the meetings and the marketers would say, well, when you said that about correlation, what did you mean about that? And what did you do with that? And I don't understand this. And we must have done with each marketing person, must have done 50 hours or 100 hours of joint meetings. And then, of course, the marketers, who are obviously better salespeople than me because that's their job, they just take all of that stuff and go out and start selling themselves. And complete with, I mean, the worst bit is obviously when they steal all your jokes. Yeah, because everyone's got a few jokes that they put into every marketing presentation, at least I do. And they would then just take everything and even do the jokes as well. And that really did turbocharge. You know, we were doing really well. 2011, 2012, I mean, we were outperforming everybody and everyone thought we had a magic machine that was making money. And at that point, we got to $4 billion, $5 billion, hard closed the main fund and launched the low-cost fund at the beginning of 2013. But that was a really fantastic time, obviously. You're growing fast and you're hiring fast. And we were doing some really clever stuff with the models, we thought, and really interesting forecasting risk and correlation. I mean, it was a great time. And then 2013 happened, and that wasn't really
so. What happened then?
Well, we had a very broad basket of models. So we'd have models or strategies, as we like to call them. Each standalone strategy would probably be good enough to run a fund on. But we thought, well, since we've got 15 different strategies, some momentum strategies, which, you know, we'd have a basket of momentum strategies, we'd have a basket of value or carry strategies, we'd have a basket of short-term strategies. And, you know, fundamentally, why wouldn't you have a basket of strategies? Because what you're doing is you're factoring out the implementation risk. I mean, I don't know, and nobody can forecast whether or not moving average crossover model is better than a conditional density estimation model. Who knows, right? I don't know. They seem to perform about the same over a long period of time in the trend following space. So if you've got the infrastructure, why don't you just run both? Right? There should be some diversification there. Also, you know, whilst trend is a very interesting source of return, there are lots of other things that you can trade as well. You can trade value or carry across lots of different asset classes. And you can also trade in the short-term space, which is, you know, 2 to 20-day holding periods, you know, shorter-term mean reversion, shorter-term momentum. So we had this basket of things, which was doing okay. And then in June 2013, just the way that the trend models were set up and the way that the value models were set up, and in particular the way that the short-term models were set up, we could not have designed a position which was worse for the announcement that the Fed were going to start tapering bond purchases, the taper tantrum. If you'd asked me to define a position which would be most badly hurt by that, this was the position that we had. Just as a result of the way that the short-term models were lined up with the long-term models. And of course, when big news events happen, you get large moves, which you get those kurtotic things. And I'm not going to say correlations break down because that will scream, but things move together in fat tail events. And so we had a bad month. I think we were down 14% on the month, which sounds like a lot. And to be fair, it is a lot. But, you know, we're running at that time a 20% volatility fund. Now, 20% volatility, you know, you can do this in your head, but I'll do it anyway. 20% annualized volatility is about a 6% standard deviation of moves every month. a little bit more than 6%. So in June 2013, we had a 2 and a bit standard deviation move, which is not the end of the world, right? It's not nice, don't get me wrong. Okay, it's really unpleasant, but it's not something that is completely outside the statistical distribution. The problem was that a lot of the investors that we had brought on board over 2010, 11, and 12, despite me saying we're just different, we're not necessarily better, they believed that we had a super magic money-making machine and didn't really understand the risk associated with the 20% volatility. So we lost some investors there. 2013, by the time we got to the end of that, we were maybe down at $3 billion AUM, which is not bad. I mean, you lose about $1 billion just on organic loss because you've lost money. And then we lost some investors. But after that, we sort of built the firm back up again. You know, lessons were learned. And every time you have a big loss, you've got to be at least honest with yourself about why that happened and whether or not there's something in the distribution that you don't get. If you're being totally honest, you also have to think about that in terms of the ups as well. If you have a massive up month, that should make you really worried because most distributions are pretty symmetric, at least for well-diversified trading firms. And if somebody's got an up 20% in their history, they've probably got a down 20% in there as well. So you have to be a little bit careful about that stuff. Anyway, and so that's where we ended up. I realized then, I think, that it would be difficult to have a reliable and stable business, which is a standalone business. And so I hired somebody to be the CEO of the business. Because you know, there's two jobs. One is the CIO, which is responsible for investment and tech and all that stuff. And then there's the CEO, who is responsible for running the business. Because a hedge fund is not really, we think about it, trading business. But actually, it's just a business. It needs to be properly run with good processes and procedures and an HR team and all of those things that you need to run a proper business. So I hired Adam Glinsman to do that, and he really tightened up the firm. And at that point, we realized we probably wanted to partner with somebody because at the end of the day, most businesses are about distribution. And if you can turbocharge your distribution, then you can hopefully grow a firm, and being part of a corporate or a larger firm gives you more stability to ride out the bad years. Now, that was one of the things that 2013 taught me was, you know, we went into 2013, I mean, aware of our own fallibility, but kind of really pleased with ourselves that, you know, we'd grown this firm from nothing to $5 billion hedge fund, you know. The FT was phoning me up to ask me stuff. You know, I felt good, right? I mean, of course you feel good about that stuff. And then, you know, by the end of the year, I thought we might go bust. And all the stuff that we'd done, all that brilliant technology, all those fantastic people, all the things that we'd done well for our investors and bad for investors, all the intellectual property, just could have disappeared. If we'd had another big leg down in 2013, I wouldn't be here talking to you, Nikita. And I was well aware of how close that edge was. And it is easier and better, I think, for employees as well, to have some more stability and have the balance sheet and the long-term investments in the business that you can get with a partner. I mean, I always said that, you know, people would say, well, you know, what's your long-term strategy for Cantab? And I would always say, let's not go bust before the end of the week. If you can not go bust before the end of the week, then I think you're doing a pretty good job.
That's the second part of the phrase, right? A short-term focused, but a long-term greedy. But yeah, I mean, it's in the hedge fund world, it's amazing how quickly things change. I guess one point that I would kind of be really curious to hear your thoughts on is that it sounds like there is almost like a predefined boundary for some funds to scale up. So obviously there is like capacity and all of that. But there is also like a natural thing from the standpoint of the business that when you get to like 50, 60 people firm, then it becomes much more like a business. When it's again like a couple of people and the Bloomberg, especially for like discretionary shops, this kind of introduces like an extra requirement for the founder or for the senior partners to lead the firm, to come up with the vision and so on. And maybe like also to venture out, because that's where lots of the firms fail as well. And the very few succeed at the big scale, where I'm thinking about like the D shows or like the Citadels and so on. How do you think about this interaction?
The thing that's the big eye-opener is when you start dealing with the pension consultants, because they are very focused investors, right? And they're focused on the investment process and the risk management processes and all of those things that they should be. But they also say, you know, who signs off on cash transfers between accounts? Oh, wait, what do you mean? Well, you know, there should be two people signing off on every account and they should be separate. And, you know, who does your compliance and how do you make sure that compliance is sorted out? Tell me about your HR procedures. All of that stuff becomes much bigger, and it's possible to do. It's definitely possible to do if you invest in not just trading technology, but mid-office technology. So being able to make sure, one of the things that we always really like to show off about was if you've got managed accounts and a fund, then you're required by law to make sure that everyone gets the fairest allocation of fills. So you definitely don't want to go out, you know, if I've got a managed account of 100 million and a main fund of 900 million, and I've got 100 WTI to buy, then I go and buy 100 WTI and I won't get them all at the same price. And I can't get them all at the same price because there's no averaging in of price. So I have to give 10 lots to the managed account and 90 lots to the main fund. And I have to verifiably be able to show that this is that I have done this in a fair way and nobody is disadvantaged. Now, it turns out that this is a form of the knapsack problem. You can look it up on Wikipedia. The knapsack problem is when you've got M knapsacks, rucksacks, whatever it is, and N objects of different weights, and you want to make them all approximately as close as possible to the same weight by distributing the N objects in of different sizes between the M rucksack. It's a hard thing to do. It's NP incomplete. So we, rather than having somebody sitting with a spreadsheet trying to work out which fills to allocate, we just wrote an algorithm to do that. And it was demonstrably optimal. And the tracking error as a result of using that between managed accounts and the main fund was literally tens of dollars a day, $10 a day on a managed account of $500 million and a fund of $400 million. So, and that's the kind of thing that pension consultants and serious investors really want to know that you do that stuff right. And once you start getting to that, you start to realize that it's hard to grow that organically into a really big firm. There's been people who have done it. AQR is a great example of a firm which has grown from, you know, almost a boutique into something which has, you know, is a grown up, fantastically institutional asset management firm. Trying to do that though organically is hard because one of the things that we had at Cantab was the culture really revolved around the scientists, the quants and the programmers. That was the heart of the Cantab culture. And we had a great team, a fantastic team of ops people, finance people, a really amazing marketing team. But the culture of the firm was set by the quants, and well, by me as well. You know, I like that sort of geeky. It was a geeky environment. If you're going to grow organically, then that has to change. You're going to need to have a sales force of 50 people or 100 people. You're going to have an HR team of 10 people. You're going to have a compliance department. You're going to have offices all around the world. And that's something which is risky to do. It's a hard thing to do, and you may not succeed. And by distributing yourself around the world, creating distribution force, increasing the size of everything, maybe you devalue the thing that makes the firm great, which is a very small, well, not very small, a tightly knit team of quants and programmers all working in the same code base, all being less than 10 meters away from everyone else, incredibly high bandwidth communication, the culture of doing the right thing. So we really thought that the only way to do this, or the least risky way of doing this, would be to find a partner.
And this is, I guess, what makes a hedge fund sort of unique, because by nature, when you get into the billion-dollar club, then it's already like pretty well-funded business. It generates some revenue, lots of profit, and so on. Obviously, you know, the costs are there, and uncertainty is there, but it's self-sufficient business. And so there is kind of no need almost to grow it, because like it's already kind of pays the bills.
I'm going to disagree with you there, because yes, of course, you know, running a $3-5 billion hedge fund with 50 employees, all of whom are having a nice time, and in good years everyone gets paid a lot. That's and of course in bad years they don't. That does sound like quite an enticing life. Right? Why wouldn't you just do that forever? Well, the thing is that if you're hiring the right people, then those people themselves have ambition. They have career goals. And maybe for me, it would be fine to continue to do this. But maybe for the people that worked for me, you know, they need other goals, they need other things to achieve. And also, I think it's also fair to say that it is not a good thing that firms are solely dependent on the charismatic founder. Right? That's not a good thing. You know, particularly for systematic firms, it shouldn't matter whether or not I'm there, or Cliff Asness is there, or David Harding is there, or Lade is there, or anything else, because everything is encoded in systems. And, you know, I was aware of the fact that, you know, if I just went under a bus one day, you walked out of the office, crossed the road, and the bus going from the park and ride in Cambridge into the center of town knocked me down and killed me, then that would have been the end of Cantab. It would have been really hard to keep the firm going. No matter how much I said to investors, I am and was at that time, literally the least important person in the firm right now, because everyone else is doing all the programming and the modeling and the data analysis and the HR and the management of interfaces to prime brokers and service providers and so on. I wasn't critical to the firm, but everyone thinks that you're critical to the firm, and that's a bad thing to do. And that's why you want to be sustainable. You need to be more corporate. There needs to be something which continues irrespective of who the person is with the sitting at the top of the table with a big hat on.
And I suppose this was, and you already kind of partly touched on it, this was the motivation behind the acquisition by GAM.
Yes, it was. We were approached by a number of people, and there were a lot of people who, you know, for whom they wanted to take a financial stake in the firm, which doesn't really help much. I mean, for all the reasons I said before, it doesn't help if somebody wants to give you some money for part of the firm, because that doesn't change the strategic direction. But GAM came in, and you know, it was, they have a very large distribution capability, offices around the world, corporate infrastructure, and that in the end is why we decided to do it.
Makes sense, especially like given what you already mentioned. And yeah, for different people, I guess the motivation is different, but it all makes sense. In the industry, there is a lot of information, and like the day-to-day we're overloaded, and the year-by-year, this information intake only grows exponentially. And so what advice that is believed to be a common knowledge in the industry you disagree the most? It could be like a career advice or some like approach that CEOs are taking.
I disagree with quite a lot of things in the industry. I do think that way too much emphasis is given to trying to pick winners as opposed to just constructing an optimal portfolio. So people spend an awful lot of time trying to pick winners in the stock market, or alternatively, pick managers who pick winners in the stock market. But a much, much bigger effect on their long-run risk-adjusted returns is whether or not what their allocation to bonds, real estate, hedge funds, and infrastructure is. That's a much, much more important thing than trying to find somebody who has true insight into the future. I think it is probably the case, it's arguably the case, that nobody has any insight into the future beyond small biases in the world. So there's a small trend following bias. There's a small, much as it hasn't worked for a very long time, there's a small bias to buy cheap companies, sell expensive companies. There's a small bias to buy high-yield currencies, sell low-yield currencies. all of these biases, or the quality bias or the momentum bias, they're all small, really tiny. And the only way that you can make them work is by making them work over hundreds of commodities or futures contracts or currencies or thousands of stocks. And I think that there's a belief that there's a belief that some people really do see into the future, okay, which I find hard to accept. There's also a belief, and you see this a lot when everyone gets breathlessly excited about AI and machine learning in finance, or whatever the latest thing is, quantum computing in finance. There's an almost deeply embedded desire in people in finance to believe that there is a solution to the problem. Going back to what we talked about earlier, remember we talked about Isaac Asimov and science fiction. And in the Foundation novels, there is Harry Seldon, who has this, you know, it's not described quite like this, but he just has this giant equation which forecasts the entire galaxy a millennia forward. It's a huge thing. It's called the plan. And I think there's a belief in some investors, many investors, that somewhere out there, there is a formula, a system that will just tell you what's going to happen to the S&P tomorrow. Right? And that isn't going to happen. It's just, it's the lack of really understanding that finance is almost noise. It's almost, it's not Gaussian noise, although if you volatility adjust your returns, it gets close to Gaussian, but it is still does have some fat tails. But it's mostly noise. And for a lot of people, I don't think that sinks in enough. I will caveat that a bit by saying there are some small areas, maybe niche areas, where there might be effects which are more predictable, where the noise cancels out, or where there are effects in finance that mean you really can get a Sharpe ratio of 10 or something. But almost by definition, those have to be niche and they have to be small. Because if they weren't niche and they weren't small and they were big, everyone would know about them. But they don't, right? So I don't know, maybe there's niche in, cryptocurrencies. Not an area I know particularly well, but maybe there's some effects going on in those markets where you really can predict it because the predictability hasn't washed out of the markets. And if somebody proved to me that that was the case, I wouldn't disagree with that. But you know, for all the hype, you know, there isn't really that much Bitcoin traded. You know, if you want to trade high frequency Bitcoin, you're not going to be a $10 billion fund. And there's $50 trillion, let's not forget $1 trillion of investable assets out there. So the fact that for $200 million of assets, you can really get a Sharpe ratio of 5, let's say, I'm just making these things up, out of cryptocurrencies or cheese trading or commodity trade finance or whatever these things are, that's interesting, but it's not revolutionary in finance because you've got $50 trillion of investable assets that you've got to invest, and not everyone's going to get into your Sharpe ratio 10 Bitcoin trading system. So that's the sort of, it sounds a bit cynical. Want to come across being cynical, but I am often skeptical of these things, and I think that's okay.
Yeah. I mean, of course, like disproving the skepticism is how people, I guess, accept the conjectures.
That's correct. Yeah.
But you raised a very interesting point, which I would want to again come back to. So like on this like portfolio construction level, because I think there is this role of incentives that plays a big component. So like these people that are doing the manager selections, that are, you know, different compartments within the research team, there is just a lot of this, you know, because like for a fund, like it probably doesn't make huge difference whether it's one person signing off the transfer, 5, 10, like it's okay. Like it's not really like a point of failure. So just there, it's like you can push further the actual risk taking into different like compartments, and like people need to justify sort of not to make it sound bad, but like to justify their job. So like, what role, if any, would you say that plays specifically for this disagreement that you have on the point of portfolio construction for investors?
I just think that with the obsession, let's say, with trying to pick managers, I always, or trying to pick outperformers or whatever that might be, I always say to people, let's just look at a risk parity portfolio, okay? Here's two things. Here's your manager, which is running at a Sharpe ratio of 1.5 for the past 10 years, well, they might actually just be a bit long equities, because equities have been running at a Sharpe ratio of one anyway. So, you know, how hard is that? But then let's compare to risk parity. Now, I'm not saying that risk parity is necessarily the be-all and end-all of investing. It's not. But it has in the past, and we've got to use very careful language here, it has in the past performed exceptionally well. But somehow people look at it and go, oh, yeah, but that's only because bonds have gone up and equities have gone up. And you go, well, yeah, it has. So what's wrong with this? Well, bonds can only go down from here. Okay, but what about equities? Oh, no, they can keep going up. Okay, I mean, that's all fine, but it doesn't say this is a wrong thing to do. Why don't you start there and then add your outperformers or whatever it might be? I mean, given the fact that when allocators allocate money, they're not allocating money, they're allocating risk budget. Okay? You've got a certain amount of risk. You're running a $10 billion US public pension fund, and you have to have a volatility of 6% or less, and you have to try and return 6%. Otherwise, you go bust. Right. So you've got that volatility to allocate. So allocate risk rather than thinking about allocating money. Because when you allocate money, you just allocate way too much to equities and you just become dominated by equities. And I know that being dominated by equities has been a truly amazing trade since 2009. And for years, I've been saying, well, it's got to end at some point. And it keeps going. I mean, there we are. And, you know, I sort of literally don't understand. But it would seem to me that a more balanced portfolio is likely to be not a bad thing over a 10 to 20 year horizon. But people care more about whether or not Tesla's going up or down.
Yeah, and it's only going up these days.
It's definitely only going up these days, and I don't want to upset anybody, but a car maker that doesn't make very many cars and doesn't make any profitability cannot be the biggest car maker in the world, but maybe they can in the future, I don't know.
And I have two more questions. So you have been recognized on a number of occasions as a leading figure in the hedge fund industry, and you recently got a lifetime award from the HFM. What do you think were some of the biggest contributors to your success?
I think I'm a relatively easy person to get on with. I try not to annoy people too much. And I think that's probably quite a good thing to be. I think it's very important to remember, you know, when you're in any sphere, whether or not it's you are the, you know, you're in the hedge fund sphere, or you're running a FTSE 100 company, or you're a lawyer, or any of those other things. I think the very first thing that you need to do is try and be nice to everybody, because one day you'll need a friend. Something will go horribly wrong, and you need people to think that you're an okay guy or an okay woman, and you've got their back, and you're being generally reasonably nice to people. So I think that really helps. I think that's something that makes it easier for people to talk to you. I think being as honest as you possibly can, and not always can you be honest. There are situations in business, and there are situations in when you are dealing with clients or investors where it's not that you should, it's not that you ever lie. And of course, nobody ever lies in that sense. And I certainly would never do that. But sometimes there are sins of omission. There are things that you just can't talk about because you're stopped from talking about it because of some other agreement with some other person, and you just have to not mention certain things. But as far as possible, you should always be as honest as you can possibly be. And sometimes, and one of the things that maybe is more unusual about the way that I talk about what we do is I'm really uncertain about it. I really don't know. I don't know the answer because there isn't an answer. All you can do is do the best thing that you can possibly think of doing at the moment. But I don't know whether or not the portfolio design algorithm that the Cantab problem, the ex-Cantab funds use, I don't know if that's the best in the world. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow in the bond market. I don't know whether or not forecasting volatility in this way or that way or using a Garch model or high-frequency data, I don't know the answer to all of those things. What I do know is that you can do experiments. I mean, that's one of the great things about systematic trading is you can do a form of experimentation on the past. It's a very dangerous, difficult thing to do, and there's lots of pitfalls, and every day somebody learns a new pitfall about backtesting or simulating strategies because there are many, many. But you can perform that, and you can at least look at the relative performance of two things. You know, I might have volatility forecasting strategy A and volatility forecasting strategy B. Now, I can run them against historical data. I can do in-sample or out-of-sample or jackknife optimization or whatever it is, and I can get some results. Now, the first thing, to go back to what I said about 10 minutes ago, is remember there's an enormous amount of noise in here. So the results aren't going to be very good. This is not going to be a five sigma discover the Higgs boson sort of event. This is going to be something where within some quite loose bounds, you're not going to have a P less than 0.05 to say this volatility forecasting regime is or technique is better than this one. You're just going to get an indication of that. And so you should always be uncertain. The thing that you have to really avoid is coming up with some new model or new system and then convincing yourself that it's great. That's the cardinal sin of systematic trading, is you come up with a model, you probably maybe have a little bit of a peek at the out-of-sample data, or you maybe know the out-of-sample data, because remember, we've only got one history. And then you convince yourself that this model is fantastic. And actually, what you should spend yourself doing and spend your time doing is one of the things that we used to do a lot and still do in our quantitative meetings, is once somebody's come up with a strategy or a technique, a new volatility forecasting routine, a new cost optimizing system, you spend a lot of time trying to break it, not trying to convince yourself that it's good. And that's one of the reasons why openness is a very important part of the research process. Every piece of code, every bit of research should be open to everyone, and everyone should be able to comment on it. And nobody gets a pass because they've been doing it for a long time. You know, I've lost count of the number of times where somebody that I have hired aged 24 and has been in the firm for 6 months looks at some of my work and says, that's rubbish. Let's not do that. And I go, okay, that's fine. Show me why it's rubbish. Oh, yeah, you're right. It is rubbish. And that's really important, right? It has to be a collective decision without the imprint of authority on the top of it. Somebody has to make the final decision. And at the end of the day, you will have one or two or 10 different ways of doing things with evidence associated with them. And somebody, the CIO, and if that was me, then it's me, eventually you have to make a decision. And you say, okay, on balance, this probably looks like the best one, but we don't know. So I think being honest and being able to express uncertainty, I think that is something which is unusual in finance. Well, I mean, honesty is not unusual. Most people are very honest in finance. But being able to express uncertainty is definitely unusual. And I think that's sort of helped, or is one of the parts of my profile that people kind of enjoy.
Yeah, I think it's pretty important, and like how these things are interlinked, because when you are showing the uncertainty, then like you resonate a bit more with people and then they trust you more. And like not being attached to the ideas, that's also very, very important. Just being able to scrape it off and start from the beginning. Because that's, yeah, it's easy to get entitled when things are happening. And so like, so this was kind of more or less, I wouldn't call it a recipe, but these are some of the things that you think that helped you to succeed. But what are three pieces of advice that you would give to your younger self? That I guess would be a bit more generalized.
Well, the first piece of advice is a bit of flippant advice, which is in 2009, when you download that piece of code to mine these new things called bitcoins, actually compile it and run it and just mine a few thousand bitcoins and keep them in a wallet, you idiot, as opposed to downloading it and then getting bored and moving on and doing something else, because probably Bitcoin wasn't going to be anything. So that's bit of advice one. More important bits of advice: when things are tough, don't worry, it will get better, because you go through lots of times. I mean, whether or not it's, you know, when things are tough at work, you know, I slept under my desk at Goldman Sachs for 3 days during 9/11, trying to get the NYMEX trading exchange up and running. During 2000, when we were starting Cantab and the quant quake happened, you know, I was probably awake 20 hours a day trying to work out, you know, what we were going to do and where we were going to make it. And it feels like you're never going to get out of that. And the thing I would say to my younger self is, don't worry, it'll be okay. That's the second thing. And the third thing is, you can't spend too much time with your family. You can't. There's an awful lot of, in any job, there's a lot of time that you spend traveling. You know, I'd be on planes to the States, I'd be away, I'd be, you know, or in Australia for a week trying to sell some Cantab fund to Australian supers. You tend to do, you have long hours sometimes, meetings in London that go on and on and on. But the thing you have to remember is that when you come home, that is not work time, that is family time. And I tried very hard at Goldman and also Cantab to make sure that there was that very clear divide, so that, yes, you can work hard, but you have to continue to realize, maybe not something to say to investors, but at the end of the day, it's a job. A job is as your life. I think I did pretty well at that. But there's always room for improvement.
Thank you very much, Ewan. It's been extremely interesting and informative learning about your life lessons, your career, your aspirations. It's been really, really interesting. Thank you very much for spending the time with us today. Speak soon.
Okay, speak soon. That was very enjoyable. Thank you very much. Real pleasure to do it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Speaking to Legends. I hope you found it to be useful and thought-provoking. If you enjoyed this show, please write a review on iTunes to support us. Stay tuned.